Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to a new episode of the Talking About Platforms podcast. My name is Philip Meyer, and I'm here with my regular co-host, Daniel Trabucchi. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Philip. Hi, everyone.
And of course, we have another exciting guest. Her name is Lindsay D. Cameron. She's an assistant professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. She's also a faculty affiliate at the Bertman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Her research interests include, among others, algorithmic management, artificial intelligence, and platform work. Lindsay, welcome to Talking About Platforms.
Thank you. I'm a fan of your show, and I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you very much for being here with us. And, you know, the very first question, it's pretty obvious in a podcast talking about platforms. We do all talk about platforms, but we often mean something slightly different. So we like to open our show with your kind of definition of platforms and also getting a bit more personal, how you end up studying platforms and what brought you in this research field.
You know what? So that's a great question. And let me flip it and answer the second part first. When I was research thinking about dissertation topics, you know, I had these little memos I would visit my advisor about and visit really everyone in the department. And we were two-sided and I had three different memos about different topics. And I was very interested in downward social mobility. I saw my mom lose her job in the Great Recession. She ran a very large call center and she has an associate's degree, which is a two-year degree in the United States. There's a lot of age discrimination. I'm also African-American or Black. And so she just could not re-enter the traditional labor market. And she did lots of gig jobs. She worked in warehouses at night. She sold food samples in grocery stores. She sold purses at trade stores or trademarts. And I really saw her try to stay middle class, even though her income was very lower class. And I mean, this to me was gig work. And so I was very interested in social mobility and how do people try to stop downward social mobility. And it was my advisor who said, well, this is your topic. You know, I was talking to people through interviews that were going through layoffs and things. And he said, why don't you bound it by an organization? So when I went through my preliminary data, I saw most people were on these labor platforms like Uber and TaskRabbit and Upwork as a way to stop downward social mobility after there had been some sort of economic jolt in their life. So I, of course, you know, theoretically, platforms mean a lot of things, innovation, digital, labor. But really, I care about labor platforms because that's what brought me into this, watching my mother. And by the way, things ended up just fine for her. It took about 8 years for her to re-enter the traditional labor market. And now she is happily retired, spending time with her grandkids.
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing. You do a lot of work regarding platform power, I would say, and quote unquote fairness, like the treatment of, on the one side, the contributors of the labor on the platform, but also the consumers, so to say. How do particularly these like gig platforms or labor platforms, let's say, exploit their centrality in comparison to non-labor platform? Is there something that is in this regard special to the labor platforms?
That's interesting. Something I've been thinking about as I'm developing some book ideas. You know, I often think about the Zimmel quote when he's talking about triadic relationships, and he talks about how there's the third that always rejoices, you know, when they're doing the connection. And so I think, you know, I think there's one way you could argue that the digital platforms are neutral, but at the end, but I think anybody who's a serious social scientist knows how technology and values are embedded in technology. And I think fundamentally, when we're talking about the invisible hand and greater sort of disaggregation of labor power to get work down to the transactional level so it can all be visible and counted, these ideas of exploitation are embedded into platform design. And they're in digital platforms, they're in innovation platforms, they're in labor platforms. I think with labor platforms, it's just easier to see because you have individuals telling their stories. You can see the decline in wages. You can see the safety violations that are happening. But when you think about a company like Apple, which, you know, what is it, has like a $3 trillion market cap, like this is a platform that is shaping our lives, that has a lot of data on us, that's, you know, shaping us at these micro level with all of these nudges. That is power that can be used in terms of exploitation. But I think because it's so subtle and so insidious, it's much harder to see how these digital platforms are also reshaping the economy.
Last season, we had Willy Lehtonwirte on.
It's becoming the most recited guest we had in all the seasons.
Cloud empires.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about cloud empires when it was just published. And I think he shows the very interesting story of the early days of the platforms. Mm-hmm. and how, like, what a positive ideology and cause the platforms started. So in your opinion, is it inherent to the model that through, like, the centrality, and at some point some of these platforms, the winner take all position that they occupy, that they become more exploitive over time? Although, as Willy shows in his book, at least some of those platforms that we talk about today, maybe not Uber, but for example, eBay, started out, at least that's how the picture he paints. Maybe you have a different opinion on that, as something positive.
And he goes, you know, he goes much further back, you know, if you're thinking about eBay, if you're thinking about Craigslist as possible platforms, you know, and I think because I start a lot of my intellectual start is really focused around labor, that's central. Mm-hmm. I do see that more as baked in than these sort of digital, almost those are, eBay is closer to a marketplace for me than I think is how I would hold as a platform. But I do think there's a co-option of the sharing economy that was done in the early days of labor platform that made it seem more positive than it was. I mean, think of the fact that we call it ride sharing originally and not ride hailing. Those imply two different things, and ride hailing, Uber and Lyft, is not blah blah car. You know, blah blah car was like, hey, I'm going from Toulouse to Strasbourg, who wants to get in the car with me? That's not how these platforms have evolved, but it was an early part of their rhetoric, part of, I would almost like a greenwashing of the narrative they're sharing that allowed them to become so popular and grow. And there are other parts of their greenwashing narrative as well that I'd say have been really successful.
Do you think that this idea of the sharing was actually the key behind the diffusion, or do you think it had a kind of a role in the washing afterwards, meaning that, you know, when you talk about platforms based on labor, nowadays we've got a quite huge amount of examples that are very different from pure labor platforms. If I think about those marketplaces where you go and you offer your professional work, now I don't find the name in this exact moment. Uber, in a way, now it's something similar. So you do invest your time there to have a job, but was not exactly thought in that way. If you take like food delivery apps, again, they do require a part of labor, but actually the overall mission was actually to spread food. So in a way, the second customer were the restaurants in the first place. So in all these cases, you've got labor at the center, but they are a bit different, in my opinion, towards the people that are working there in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, so a few different ways. That's a great and very thoughtful question. So when I think of labor platforms, I actually make a distinction between open and closed labor. So open labor markets are the Upworks that focus more like a marketplace as opposed to a closed labor market like DoorDash or Uber, where algorithmic management is much more tightly controlling workers. So I just wanted to make that not to be a monolithic in thinking about labor. You know, Airbnb, I would say the one it's sort of what I think of as a traditional as a platform company. I know it's Airbnb is not quite a labor platform because it's so capital intensive, but it does take a fair amount of labor to respond to those messages and turn around a property. Is the one that I feel like at least started with the ethos that was closest to the sharing economy. You know, when I think about Uber and its origin narrative, you know, Travis definitely says, I wanted to be a baller, you know, and wanted my friends to be ballers too and get in the car with me. Or there's also another origin narrative about him just needing a ride. I think it was either in San Francisco or Paris and couldn't find one. And so there is a little bit of sharing there, but I think Uber and the other ride hailing companies were very thoughtful in doing co-option and particularly around racial politics and around gender issues to show this was safe. You know, some of their early advertising had attractive young white women walking into a Lyft. And that's implying, hey, this is a safe mode of transport for a young, pretty woman, particularly in the evening, as compared to, you know, what the other options are with taxis. Similar, you know, about how they would reduce the number of drunk driving drafts when they went into the area or gave transportation options to areas that were underserved, which were typically always minority and poor. So I think in the early days of Uber, there was much more of a social narrative that that the ride hailing company was using that's broader than sharing that helped it sort of move forward. And then lastly, to talk into your point about DoorDash and these other sort of companies that just don't fork on workers as labor, this is where my research is going next. I have some papers about it and I'm thinking about it, but it's how are these companies building an ecosystem? And I don't mean ecosystem like in the more strategic, like complement or sort of sense, but it's almost like creating these little cottage industries to help them create more reliable ways to ensure their main mission. So will there be financing arms to help drivers get cars? Will they have digital wallets for people? You know, you think about Grab, which is this super consolidator app that's in Southeast Asia. And these financing arms I see mostly in Latin America and in Sub-Saharan Africa and other places in the global south. I think there's a way in which they're bringing in more, they're either creating or making relationships with these, I call them platform mediated franchisers, these little cottage industries, or it can be like a restaurant or a grocery store that make them part of the platform world and make them, it creates that dependence between the two. But there's always the platform in the center that enjoys the most power because it has the most information. But in bringing more and more actors into the system, you're making platform work much more sticky, which goes back to our previous earlier conversation about like, why does this continue to grow? Why is it its core is this exploitative? And it has a lot to do with the currency and power that accumulates in the central node.
Well, I think it's very interesting, the examples you came up with. On the one hand, DoorDash and those types of apps probably let us have another link with another guest we had, that is Elizabeth Altman, when she talked about workforce ecosystem. So the platform there is multi-sided, having for sure the end users and the restaurants, but somehow the riders may be or may not be aside depending on the various definition, but for sure are part of an external workforce that make the platforms happening. But there was something in what you described at the beginning on Uber, when you said that at the beginning especially there was this kind of storytelling related to security and, you know, accessibility and things like that. And this made me think about Airbnb. You know, when I teach the Airbnb case in class, I always highlight a turning point in 2012 when they stop kind of saying you can rent a room or wherever you are in a city and sleep on the couch of someone else. But they start saying Airbnb is belong anywhere. It means that you can see a city through the eyes of someone that lives there. You can meet the people. You can actually spend time with people from that place. If we go fast forward in 2024, the vast majority of the bookings on Airbnb are not going in that direction anymore. Because you simply book, you spend your night there, you still see the city through the eyes of someone that lives there more than in an hotel, probably, but you don't meet anyone. And something I always, well, I have my answer, but I'm curious to hear yours. How much this is driven by the platform? The storytelling, for sure, it's driven, but in a way, the interactions on the platform. So the fact that the host behave in a certain way and the end users behave in another way may actually drift away the overall proposition of the platform. So Airbnb is not that belong anywhere anymore. But do you see it as coming more from the platform, coming more from the sites? Do you see something happening for both reasons? Because I totally agree with you on the platform power in a way, but I see also the sites having a strong power in influencing the overall platform population.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really great example. And I would almost see Airbnb here as an outlier, you know, in part because it's not a pure labor. It's closer to a capital sort of platform that I do think it is here, the workers or the customer, the client, the guests, and the hosts that shifted Airbnb away, just because consumers are so comfortable already with the idea of having sort of like a solo room in their own space. That sort of drove demand in a particular direction. And I think, you know, Airbnb was smart and pivoted. And they also have these Airbnb experiences, though, which means you can get your local flavor in a way that's more palatable. You can choose how long you want it for and the length of that interaction, as opposed to, you know, being in someone's house and having less control over it. So I do think that is an example of where the platform has less power than, say, like a ride hailing or a food delivery company.
You know, I go on quite often telling this story about Airbnb, but it's true that if we take food delivery platforms, DoorDash in the States or Deliveroo in Europe, the restaurants can definitely drift the type of kitchen, the type of food, the quality level, but that's everything they can influence. Probably it's more difficult to go beyond that.
And to think about there's an Academy of Management Annals paper I wrote that talked about platform power. I think that was actually the title. Taming Platform Power, Taking Accountability into Account in the Management of Platforms. And in here I talk, you know, how there's two different perspectives of platform accountability. One is very bottom up, which is like, what can the workers do? And the other is more top down, which is like, what does regulation can do? Mm-hmm. And I think with Airbnb, you need regulators at a much higher level. We all know how you have these Airbnbs in certain cities in Europe. You know, I think it's like Lisbon is one of the ones that often uses the case example that drives up prices in the neighborhood that, you know, regular people can no longer afford to rent. It increases the rate of gentrification. And so in that issue, like there is, the platform didn't change the narrative about what it was used for. I think the customer, you know, you just let the market in that way decide. And I use market in quotation marks, but there are real effects for where the ecosystem is, the Airbnb is located at. And that's where we're going to need to think about accountability from a different actor coming in from the more regulatory level to let this not just sort of go out of control. We have all little Airbnb pod neighborhoods. I mean, Milan would be such a much more disappointing city if everything was just, it would compromise the beauty of Milan, you know, if you had old neighborhoods like that full of transient Americans walking around with our away roller bags.
Yeah, I mean, the topic of the top-down regulation is one that I also have on my notes. And reading through your work, what I also noted down is that there's a very good idea on how to hold these labor platforms more accountable. I think you're right about transparent, consistent, and non-arbitrary rules and procedures. You talk about ensuring equitable access to opportunities and outcomes for all actors and safeguarding against action that solely benefit the platform owner at the expense of the other actors. And then you go on and say that there is a need for top-down regulation and there is bottom-up regulation, but both fall short here and there for different reasons, mm-hmm. right? So for the top-down, it's, for example, lobbying activity, inconsistent reinforcement of regulation, or in general, like the reactive nature of regulation that
yes.
is often the case that these platforms can maneuver through small initiatives that grow in maybe in individual countries, but maybe they have a global scope. So here, my question would be, especially for the labor platforms, why is there no, in your opinion, stronger like national activity, or do you see some interesting cases that come through the empowerment of the individual acting on the platform as a worker vis-a-vis trying to regulate individual platforms on a like on a top-down level? Mm-hmm. Because I can tell you that you probably know that in Germany, Uber, for example, is not here. It's not possible to drive for Uber as an individual. You cannot just sign up, download the app, and put your service on the Uber marketplace. Mm-hmm. But rather, it's companies. But what happens that there are companies now that just employ drivers, and I mean, at least they pay the minimum wage and they also get a health insurance. So that's a mm-hmm. plus, mm-hmm. but it's still like a new industry with new gatekeepers that help a company like Uber to maneuver through this regulation. So yeah, long question.
Yes. Well, I was just in Berlin collecting data this summer, so I am becoming very well aware of these third-party intermediaries. And I mean, that's back to the question, the comment, or some of my research I was talking about creating more organizational forums that basically help Uber or these labor platforms do a better job. And I mean, we've seen these fleet owner companies are just arising in more and more companies, you know, our countries. I feel like it started really in Europe, you know, with Spain and the Riders Law, and in Germany. And, you know, you see it now even in some countries in the global south. You know, thinking about the US, there's been question marks in that some rider guilds or collectives don't want to join organized labor for whatever reason. They feel like their voices won't be heard, their interests are not aligned, that there's some sort of bloat that's in the unions, their interests, like I said before, will be co-opted. And so I've seen a lot of these guilds or collectives kind of do their own movement in their geographic area, which has some effects. I mean, you think there's cities like New York, Seattle, Minneapolis that have been able to do minimum wages and some sort of protection for workers. I think the problem is what we're seeing is the labor, and particularly ride hailing, because that's sort of my expertise. I've done actually a lot of work with different governments and around legal consulting and expert witnessing around this, is that they have really pushed to have legislation around these companies done not at the municipal level, but at the state level. Because typically cities, particularly large cities in the US, are much more liberal than the state government is. And so in this way, I feel like these companies have done a very successful job of dividing. Like already you've got an atomized labor force that's not going to a workplace, that doesn't know anybody, you know, they don't know anyone, they're suspicious of traditional union structures. But by forcing these regulations to be bartered at a state by state level means that you're not getting that same sort of national might that could be that top-down regulation. But I think this also ties back to, you know, other ideas that I've been, you know, future research is like platform work is monolithic. I think there's a lot of ways you can look at the algorithmic management systems and the scalability that's inherent in that and think, oh yes, I can just turn on a button and this platform now works in Singapore, in Malaysia, in Nigeria, in Ecuador. And, you know, there's some research, you know, by Alex Wood and others that looks at that for these sort of global online digital platforms, the open labor market platforms like Upwork, which has found, you know, some similarities where they've been able to you know, pool some of that data across different countries. But I think for in-person labor, there's much more of an interaction between the institutional context and the country and the regulations and how that platform work looks like. It's back to this idea of varieties of capitalism, varieties of Uberization and platformization. And that's why we're getting a labor platform economy that looks very different in Estonia, Lithuania, Spain, and Germany than what it's going to look like in the United States, which is certainly quite different from what it looks like in Brazil, because I've also been in Brazil collecting data. And so I'm not sure the literature, I think it's just starting to think about the idea that platform work and how accountability might look like is not going to be monolithic.
Mm. Yeah, that's super interesting, especially with the ride-hailing. So here, there's a competitor, like in Berlin, you have Uber and you have Bolt typically, and then you have a German company, Freenow, that also mm-hmm. offers mm-hmm. services. Often it's the same drivers that then run multiple applications in their cars. But what I think is interesting, we also had a service for a few years that was called Bärlkönig. And Bärlkönig was a collaboration between the local public transport agency with a startup to run their own like little shuttle service with an app that would pick you up. And the very nice thing with their service was that the actual quality of service was much higher. So it was a dedicated vehicle. It was not a passenger car, but a minibus. You had more space, you had more privacy. It was competitively priced. So it was not much more expensive. It was maybe a little bit less available, but the service at some point disappeared because the public transport agency, I think they lost the funding opportunity for that. I'm thinking, why is this not something? If the regulation on the labor side of things or the case-by-case regulation for these platforms, it has these limits, there is a way to offer an alternative. You know, don't you think you're laughing?
I think I used to live in Germany, by the way. I used to live in Darmstadt. Lots of respect for German culture. You guys are orderly. You get more things done in a more efficient way. You know, I feel like this has been tried in the United North America has not gone so well. There's a suburb of Toronto that did something similar, partnering public transport with these on-demand apps, particularly, you know, there's a lot of senior citizens, you know, have to go to dialysis or medical appointments and to get rides. And just as the cost of these services soared, which eventually they had to because they were subsidizing these rides for so long, it bloated the budget so much. And you can't have, they couldn't give the same level of service. And what are you going to do? Tell elderly people who rely on public assistance they can't go to the doctor anymore? And I know in the United States, you know, if you're receiving public, public social assistance, public social welfare benefits like Medicare to go to the doctor, particularly if you're older, you can like request an Uber or Lyft. Then people are not as invested in actually showing up for that ride. They might cancel the doctor's appointment and not cancel the ride. So I think I've seen a lot of slippages in that relationship when it's between the on-demand transport company and the public transport system. Where I'm seeing some more optimism is like in the city of Atlanta, there it's actually owned by the public transport system. And they, within it, are offering on-demand rides for sort of like this first and last mile micro mobility. That seems to be working better. The issues you have there, I think there are issues more around safety, around drivers, because sometimes they're waiting in areas that aren't with other bus drivers, and so they're at higher risk of robbery. But I would expect to see more of it actually being fully owned by the government offering this type of service than seeing success, at least in North America, between these public-private partnerships that were successful in Berlin.
Yeah. When I think about the ownership, we also had Trevor Schultz on mm-hmm. last season talking about platform cooperatives as an alternative way to like have it owned by the people offering the service on the platform. And with that, I think there are also some small success cases here and there, but I'm a bit torn because on the one hand, it seems that especially for a platform like Uber, like offering rides and connecting people to like the service of getting from A to B, it does not sound like an unsolvable problem for a collective, like on a technical level. And then the question, why is there not more activity in individual cities from service providers, drivers, maybe also the taxi, like there's even a professional cab that is in danger by these like global platforms, mm-hmm. and not at least not yet organizing around their own initiatives on a like higher scale. And I'm wondering why not.
I think you're right to the point that it's technically not as challenging. I think the margins are so low. And that's one of the reasons why you need public to step in and why I think you have this great success case in Germany. Now, there's a company that I'm a huge fan of. It's called Nosh. The one is called Nosh, the other one's called Chomp. And they're food delivery companies that are based in the American West. And what they did, like this is an example where typically food delivery margins are quite thin, which is why for a long time in the States, you could really only get pizza and Chinese food delivered to you. And what these companies saw, or no, these were restaurant owners. They saw that during the time of COVID, there was huge margins to be made in food delivery. They didn't want to rely on these national third-party companies that were going to charge much larger fees. And they really went online and found developers that built their own food delivery company. And it's run much more as a cooperative. The drivers earn a much higher wage. The restaurants are able to take a much larger part of their profits, not having to do these same like loss leader promotions. I think that's a really example of where the market conditions were right and people were able to make more of this cooperative structure that worked. You know, one thing that I think is the limitation of Nosh and Chomp, as wonderful as they are, is they're only really working in a small number of cities in the American West where there's a lot of solidarity, where people really care about buying local as opposed to having their money go elsewhere. And they can offer quasi full-time employment to workers because their demand is very, you know, cyclical, you know, as opposed to like, say, on a DoorDash app, yeah, there's going to be lower demand at 2 p.m., but there'll be some demand. But I think on these smaller apps, they can't offer the same amount of demand. So they are not really interested in scaling in the same way too, also just because they're local restaurant owners who came together. But I think it's a really nice example, you know, thinking about your question and thinking about Trevor's research where it's intersected.
You know, while you were talking about Trevor's work, for sure, that's a way of reading this phenomenon. So thinking about the laborers themselves that can actually group together and make the platform, basically, with the platform cooperatives. While you were talking about the transportation, though, I was actually bringing my lenses in. When we talk about platform thinking, we tend to talk about the established organization that evolve or approach or develop some initiatives in the platform world. And probably this could be another way of bridging the issue, because if you've got the established organization that see the power of workforce ecosystems, so that open ups to the external labor market, still with the legacy of an established organization, probably you could guarantee something more that for a startup, it's difficult for the way in which you are starting from the very beginning, at least in the first place. Then in the evolution, probably it's a governance choice and, you know, you have opportunities in all the situations, but that might be another way to explore the positive opportunities of the platform world.
Yeah, you know, and in this, actually, you had me think about Mary Gray, and I think it's Siddharth Suri's book, Ghost Work, How to Stop Silicon Valley from Creating a New Underclass. And they looked at these individuals who are doing this online, fully remote work, but they're often in labor platforms that are housed by Microsoft or housed by Amazon. They have their own little supply of labor. Now, I haven't seen any comparisons that say compare that to, say, Fiverr or Upwork or MTurk. But, you know, I do think that some companies are seeing this opportunity as a way to have this readily available contingent labor pool.
You know, we have a regular question for opening. We do have also a regular question for going towards the end. That is not looking at the past, so how you got in the platform world, but what's coming next. So what are, in your opinion, the key elements to pay attention to when dealing with platforms, or if you want to share something about it, what you're working on?
The global south. I think there is ways of which on-demand platform work sort of is trying to formalize parts of the economy that are very much informal. And you can kind of see this in North America or the global north, but it's much it's easier to see some of these things in the global south. And I think often to think about, you know, you've probably seen that quote, the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. I think more of the future is actually happening at the global south, because you're going to have to think about how do they integrate this type of quasi-formal work into their economy? What are labor rights? Where is the technology falling short? And you actually see humans coming into doing all that computational labor. So that is where I think there's a lot of exciting potential in thinking about platforms. I also think there's a lot of potential in looking at these industries that are all coming up to support platform work. And, you know, Philip mentioned some good ones around creating on-demand transport, but it's, you know, helping people get financing for their vehicles, or fleet owners who own the cars. So it's becoming a bigger part of our society, and not even just like bigger as in like two pieces coming together. It's actually becoming enmeshed in our society and shaping how decisions are making and how capital flows. And, you know, we've got to have our eyes open, eyes wide open as best we can.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. To add on that, you also mentioned Grab, and a company here in Berlin I work with is active in like the mapping and the geodata space. And what I think is very interesting in the Grab case is that the company not just utilizes the labor on the platform that brings food or groceries mm-hmm. or whatever from A to B, but they now put cameras on the helmets that automatically collect data, and they build their own maps. Yeah. Right. So even like generating new business opportunities by recognizing, especially when it comes to the mobility and ride-hailing platforms, to understand that this labor force can be used as another value generator for the platform to, for example, in this case, collect geodata and then either supply maps, because the Southeast Asian region is often not good when it comes to the data available on the classical maps like Google Maps, Apple Maps, and the European alternatives, but also building their own maps, so generating a completely new line of business based on, let's say, the shoulders of the people like delivering food. So I think this is also an interesting case I've been looking into a little bit.
I think that's fascinating. There's you might be familiar with the work of Ritha Kothari. She did her PhD at MIT. She's at Google, I think, now. But her dissertation looked at ride hailing in Indonesia, and they had different views of spatial mobility because of the deep taxi network there was there before, how they would all work at base camps and then go out, and they don't get their Grab rides or their Gojek rides just driving around the street. They wait in base camp and they wait for the rides to come to them. So I do think back to sort of like the part of the future being already seen in the global south is, I think this is a case in point. I mean, yes, you can talk about workers being used to get more data extracted to them. You can also frame it as more value creation. But no, it's fascinating where this space is going to continue to grow and evolve.
Lindsay, thank you so much for your time. If our listeners are also interested, what is the best way to follow you and your work?
So lindsaycameron.com is my website. Very straightforward. But I'm active on X/Twitter and LinkedIn. So those have all the announcements of things that are coming out too.
Perfect. We will link all these in the show notes so that everyone who is interested can follow. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.